When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Excited to be here today.
Excited to be here. We're going to review research. This is episode 308. It's our research review from September 2024. We've got some cool studies on androgen receptor density, which maybe that doesn't sound interesting to anybody else, but it's interesting to us. How your muscles can simultaneously hypertrophy and atrophy potentially, and what happens to blood pressure during exercise for people who are taking antihypertensives, so blood pressure medication. Before we get into that, Austin, how are things going, man? The people want to know, how are you?
I am intact still, as I have been on previous podcasts, but just got through a few weeks of work in the hospital. Been teaching at the medical school the past few days since I've been away from the hospital. I got to teach some second-year medical students about differential diagnosis of chest pain and vasculitis and some other interesting stuff this past week. And then the rest is doing a fair amount of training, spending time, as I have before, on the rower, some time doing some running, and still lifting, although that's taken a bit of a, side burner, not back burner, not front burner, but I've not currently operating at like peak strength performance, but I'm just kind of finding a equilibrium state to balance these different tasks that I'm training on at the moment.
For the differential diagnosis, did you just say they're not squatting enough, or that they squat with the bar in the wrong place on their back? Like that's the
linchpin. Cause of their chest pain. There you go.
That's right. Yeah, that's the idiopathology. All right. I'm moving all extremities well. Appear to be intact, as far as I'm aware. So we'll just keep on recycling oxygen into the abyss. We do have an announcement. Our pain and rehab crew has a seminar coming up in October. So that's next month in Atlanta. Great gym. We were actually there a few years back. So if you are a pain and rehab professional, so you're a PT, you're AT, you're a medical professional, or you're just a strength enthusiast, or you're a coach who works with folks, you're likely to experience some clients that will have pain. It is approved for CEUs also. So if you're a physical therapist, you're looking to get rid of that stipend here before the end of the year, that should work. You can find out more about that by clicking the link in the description of this podcast. And I think that's all I have for announcements. Anything you want to get off your chest?
Nothing else at the moment. Yeah. Expect we're behind the scenes working on some ideas and plans for some different avenues of content generation that I think people can look out for here soon, but nothing immediately pressing for this week.
Let's get into this week's podcast. Again, it's episode 308. I'm with Dr. Austin Baracchi. It's our research review. All right. The first paper, Dr. Baracchi, is called Evidence for Simultaneous Muscle Atrophy and Hypertrophy in Response to Resistance Training in Humans. Before we get into this particular paper, any predictions on what they're going to find?
Yeah, I suspect that happens, which is not, overall my initial response is like, yeah, we know that, for example, bone does the same thing. Bone is in a constant state of remodeling. There are cells that build up bone and break down bone, and it kind of gets remodeled and restructured depending on what's going on physiologically, from a hormone standpoint, from a stress stimulus standpoint, so that it happens in bone, also happens in muscle, probably also happens in all sorts of other tissues. So not shocking, but an interesting thing to discuss, because most people probably don't think about this happening in all the time, building and breaking down in muscle as well.
Yeah, like the plasticity of the muscle.
Yeah.
And like anyway, let's talk about it. So muscle hypertrophy is defined as an increase in total mass of the muscle, whereas a decrease in the total mass of a muscle is referred to as atrophy. Each muscle is made up of thousands to hundreds of thousands of muscle fibers. And in general, it's thought that the number of skeletal muscle fibers in humans is more or less fixed by the first year of life. While there's active debate around the idea that humans can increase the number of muscle fibers they have, that's called hyperplasia, the research suggests the overwhelming majority of an increased muscle mass is due to an increase in muscle fiber size. Now, from a mechanistic standpoint, muscles create force. This is known as mechanical tension when the muscle fibers receive an electric signal to contract, say, in order to lift a weight. Now, this is essential for muscle growth, as a muscle that is not loaded and required to produce force in some manner is unlikely to grow. Now, there are other mechanisms that may potentially play a role in muscular hypertrophy, but the idea here is that lifting weights imparts mechanical tension and spins up other mechanisms that may contribute to increasing muscle size of the muscles that are doing the lifting. We also know that studies looking at muscle gain in individuals during dieting phases show a reduction in the rates of muscle protein synthesis at rest, regardless of training status. Now, when you combine a calorie deficit with resistance training, muscle protein synthesis rates normalize and elevate about 30% higher than levels seen in individuals who are consuming maintenance calories. That's called an anabolic rescue. Now, long-term studies on muscle gain during calorie restriction consistently show a simultaneous increase in lean body mass and a loss of fat mass in both untrained individuals and individuals with obesity. Less is known about trained individuals, though. A number of data sets that currently exist show that it's possible to gain some muscle mass while at maintenance calories or in a deficit. Overall, however, a surplus is likely to increase muscle size more than maintenance, which is likely to increase muscle size more than a deficit, though it still appears possible to do so even when you're in a calorie deficit. Now, the purpose of this study was to evaluate the plasticity of muscles, ergo the skeletal muscle's remarkable capacity to adapt to the demands imposed on it in the surrounding environment. For example, there was one study prior to this that showed that even a nonagenarian, somebody in their 90s, was able to increase muscle force production. They still were able to adapt. It's an example of somebody's muscles plasticity. So in this study, they wanted to take a step further. How did the muscles that were loaded change compared to the muscles that weren't loaded by exercise? And did diet play any role in individuals' response? So they took 21 young, untrained individuals. The average habitual diet was about 1.3 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day and about 2,000 calories per day. They ended up splitting these folks later into a high and low calorie group because there was a pretty significant difference, about 900 calories. Those eating more calories tended to eat more protein as well. So just keep that in the back of your mind. They all did a 10-week resistance training program. They did biceps curls, lying triceps extensions, leg extensions, and leg curls. They did them with one leg at a time or one arm at a time. And they did either two or three times per week training frequency. And they did either four or three sets to failure with 60% of their 1RM. There's a secondary study that's coming out on this. I believe it's to looking at training frequency and that impact on muscle hypertrophy, but that's why there's a sort of difference there. For outcomes, they measured muscle size, so muscle cross-sectional area, using an MRI. They evaluated the size of the muscles that were trained and also the untrained muscles before and after this 10-week period. And then they also kind of split the analysis up based on a high or low calorie group. And again, the high calorie group was eating about 900 calories more than the low calorie group and also subsequently eating more protein. As far as the results go, the average weight for these subjects increased about 1.2 kilograms over the 10 weeks. Their lean body mass increased by about 1.5 kilos, while fat mass increased by about a half kilo. All of the recruited muscles in every individual that was analyzed here showed an increase in muscle size, though there was a wide range in the amount of hypertrophy that was picked up on MRI. The lowest responder increased their muscle size by about 292 milliliters, whereas the highest responder increased their muscle size by 1,148 milliliters. So big range in the amount of hypertrophy that was seen here. We've talked about that a number of times. As far as the muscles that were not recruited, there was a wide range of atrophy. Some individuals did not atrophy at all with the muscles that were not trained, whereas others atrophied quite a bit, negative 418 milliliters that was seen. The net muscle growth was also widely variable. Some saw no atrophy and only hypertrophy, and others saw basically a cancellation of their growth and atrophy. So basically, there was balanced amount of hypertrophy and atrophy. They didn't grow net at all. I imagine that's like, what if you were just only an upper body bro, right? And you were like eating at maintenance or something. And you're like, dude, my biceps are getting bigger. Secretly, your calves are just getting smaller. Yeah. As far as the diet goes, there was a relationship between protein and net growth, but the calories didn't seem to predict net growth very, very well at all. So it's mostly just related to total protein intake. The change in the non-recruited muscle, that seemed to be correlated with calories. So the amount of atrophy that people saw was kind of related to their calories, but not protein. The low energy group showed more atrophy in the non-recruited muscles than the high energy group. This is mostly in the adductor longus, the adductor magnus, and the soleus. That's a muscle underneath the calf, underneath the gastrocnemius. And the high energy group, on average, showed no atrophy. There was no difference in growth changes between men and women. So we just keep beating that drum that men and women respond similarly to training. My interpretation of this, the first thing that stands out to me is just another example of inter-individual variation. We say this all the time. People respond differently to training. And I don't know how. Like, I don't think we should stop saying that because it doesn't seem to be well appreciated yet. It's like you can put people on the same exact program and some one person is going to go gangbusters with it, get crazy strong, crazy muscle mass, and other people not going to do so well. And in saying that, I don't know how people can disagree with that because almost everything else in life is like that. Like people respond differently to going to school. People respond differently to being given certain opportunities or certain circumstances. Like that's human. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to be attracted to simple narratives around these kind of things as much as a lot of folks out there, you know, tout the narrative that like complexity sells and things like that. I also, you could also make an argument that simplicity sells.
Simplicity sells.
If you literally just do this one, two, three things, then you're guaranteed to get, you know, ideal outcomes, which is effectively not the case for almost anything that you subject a large swath of the population to. So yeah, there's both intrinsic differences between people that will lead them to respond differently, things like their genetics and training history and various other aspects, as well as more situational, contextual, environmental things that will influence how people respond to training, even within the same person at two different times in their life or in two different environments. So the number of variables is so huge. And this applies to training. This applies, as you said, to like send people to school and you'll see, you know, divergent outcomes with the same curricular, you know, implementation. Put them on a dietary intervention to lose weight, to gain weight. You're going to see people gain or lose differing amounts of weight with the same, you know, calorie target or calorie surplus or calorie deficit because of other variables that people have not really considered. So it's this idea of variability between people is the rule. It is the norm. And I think a more effective way to go about training interventions and educational interventions, if we're going to cite that one, or you know, dietary interventions, is that, as we've talked about before, this more iterative process of do something, see how the person responded, and then, you know, adjust the approach or the strategy to better match that person.
Nope, got to do the same thing every single time. That's it. Keep it tight, baby.
Yeah.
I the other impressive thing about this was this sort of idea that muscle mass reallocation like can occur, and I think if you look at this through maybe an evolutionary lens, you're like, oh, well, muscle mass is quite expensive to keep around, right? So yeah, maybe you can, you know, maintain that sort of ability to adapt by, you know, allocating muscle mass to where you need it and then, you know, removing it from places you don't need it to keep the energy costs relatively low. I don't know. It would have been nice if they tested strength here too, to see like, are there commensurate adaptations in the muscles that were unloaded to maintain force production? Because you would hope that, again, if you have to like send some expensive tissue muscle mass to someplace, that you didn't reduce function of the muscle mass that you grabbed it from just because you might need that, you know, going forward. Although then the argument against that would say, well, if you actually needed it, you would have been using it, so it wouldn't have atrophied.
Right.
So like, what's the point?
It is nice that they used MRI in this trial compared with other less accurate and precise methods of muscle volume kind of assessment.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been interesting if they tried to use dissection to see like, would that have worked? But yeah, I'll be curious to see if this study is replicated. I would have liked, if they do this again or if another research group does this, I think getting a little bit more granular on the dietary inputs would be great. The questionnaire stuff, yeah, we can go back and forth about how well do food frequency questionnaires like work or whatever. But if you're going to try to tease out some relationships between protein intake, calorie intake, or whatever, you'd probably want something a little bit more granular than just a questionnaire before and after the intervention. But I understand they didn't expect to probably find that. And so they were just like, oh, it's fine. And
hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer's here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. So you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3 month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. All right. Second study. You're going to love this. And I know you are. This study
is one to you. So yeah,
I sent it to you, but then you sent it back to me claiming that you said, I see what happened here. Okay. This study is titled Androgen Receptor Markers Do Not Differ Between Non-Responders and Responders to Resistance Training Induced Muscle Hypertrophy. That's a mouthful. So some background here. There is a wide range, as we just discussed, of inter-individual variability in strength and hypertrophy response to resistance training, and it's becoming increasingly well appreciated in the scientific literature and among practitioners, at least we hope. The primary drivers of this variability, other than genetics, still remain unclear and in some circles controversial. There's this hormone hypothesis that suggests in the acute time frame, so right after training and during training even, that, oh, the testosterone's got to go up, cortisol has to be managed, growth hormone has to go up, IGF-1 has to go up, and that's what's representing the sort of difference in people's response to training, although existing research only shows that that is not the case. There's another version of this hormone hypothesis that has to do with more chronic changes in hormone levels, so androgens like testosterone are positively correlated with lean body mass levels and inversely correlated with body fat levels in a cross section. So if you just look at the population at a given point in time, the person with the highest testosterone level, you would predict them to have the most muscle mass and the least fat mass. But if you follow these people for long periods of time, it doesn't seem to correlate longitudinally, so long term, meaning that having a higher testosterone level doesn't predict that you're going to gain more muscle mass or less muscle mass if it's lower, if you're still within the normal range. I know people on the internet that makes them very upset to hear this, but despite what people trying to sell you hormone optimization protocols will tell you, that happens to be the case based on current evidence. So if it's not the hormones, but we still want to chalk this up to maybe something going along physiologically and not just genetics and throw our hands up, maybe it's the androgen receptor. Previous work showed a correlation between blood levels of anabolic hormones like testosterone and hypertrophy outcomes. It showed a lack of correlation between intramuscular hormone levels and hypertrophy, but it did show a strong linear relationship between intramuscular androgen receptor content and hypertrophy outcomes. Basically, that's a long way of saying, hey, it wasn't the hormone level, but it was the androgen receptor. So yeah, you wrote that, Dr. Baraki. So what are we going to do now? Just throw our hands up in the air and say that was all wrong and just go make it a complete 180?
Well, I think complete 180s are relatively uncommon in science. You have to have exceptionally strong evidence to make you do a complete, you know, about face like that. Usually it's just altering your sense of the likelihood of a particular thing being accurate. And so here, you know, we had this previous evidence that fit with kind of some plausible mechanisms here of why we didn't see super strong, clear linear relationships between people's blood hormone levels. Maybe it's because even with different people at the same blood hormone level, maybe one person had way more receptors than the other, or maybe it wasn't that they had way more receptors, but their particular receptor makeup was made them way more sensitive to the same amount of hormone. All of that is like very plausible in this kind of thing. So, you know, that was the hypothesis and the evidence we had then. And so maybe this is going to adjust that probability here a bit.
Yeah. So this study aimed to further characterize the relationship between androgen receptors and muscle growth. So they took 38 young, untrained, healthy adults, or men and women. They did 10 weeks of lifting, 2 to 3 times per week. They did leg extensions for 4 sets of 9 to 12 reps to failure each set. They did a muscle biopsy of the vastus lateralis, that's the muscle on the outside of your leg, before and after this 10-week period analyze the tissue for androgen receptor density. And they also did an ultrasound of the muscles to look at any size changes. So the results, 12 of the 38 individuals did not grow greater than the typical error threshold. So basically they had an error threshold baked in to the ultrasound measured muscle size. And they were like, look, if you didn't grow past at least twice this typical error, we're just going to call you a non-responder. That's how they did that. And the 12 highest responders grew 21% on average. So to compare that to the non-responders, they grew an average of 1.3%, which is effectively not easy to measure. Now, interestingly, there was no correlation between baseline or post-intervention, so post-training, androgen receptor density, meaning that the people who were hyper responders or good responders didn't have more androgen receptors compared to those who were low responders. There was a difference in androgen receptor DNA binding. So that's when the hormone binds to the androgen receptor, and then that as a complex binds to the DNA and does stuff to the DNA, like make RNA and then translates that into protein. So the responders actually had decreased binding, which is the opposite of what you would expect.
No. This is why science can be humbling, because it's like, what on earth is going on here? Eventually, I'm sure this will be better characterized and figured out. But yeah, pretty unexpected finding, I would say here.
Yeah, well, they were like, with the DNA binding, they were like, we think that's either spurious or it's some sort of compensatory response, and we don't know what to make of it. So further study is needed. And yeah. I know people if you do go and read some of the research, and you're like, oh, more study is needed. It's like, well, this is a good example of when more study is needed, because if you were going to speculate on that, that discussion section would be untenable. It would be too long. So my take on this is that, you know, androgen receptors may not be explanatory for differences in training responsiveness after all, at least not in isolation, like on their own. in untrained folks. That was the study, right? So there's probably something else going on we just don't know about or haven't been able to tease out just yet. Or maybe this is just a particular relationship in untrained folks, right? You'd obviously want to see the study replicated a few times in untrained individuals to feel confident about that. But I think based on that previous Morton study that was done in trained individuals and showed the opposite, you're like, okay, well, how do I make sense of this? You're like, well, so maybe in untrained individuals, maybe it's not androgen receptor density, but in trained individuals, maybe it does have something to do with androgen receptor content. Because we think that androgen receptor content and density increases over years in training. So highly trained powerlifters, for example, in one study had a much higher androgen receptor content in their trapezius muscles compared to untrained. And a lack of hypertrophy response long-term to training may be due to not having this androgen receptor density increase over time. This is also a mechanism of action with super physiological doses of anabolic steroids that you get more androgen receptors to turn up in various areas. Characteristically in guys, it's in their traps and shoulders, for example. Not just guys, but just people, humans in general. Creatine also, there's some evidence showing that that may happen in the short term, but obviously not to the same degree. So I don't know. I don't think that either of us would have said that androgen receptor like content, that was the biggest non-genetic mediated sort of factor leading to differences in hypertrophy. We'd probably chalk that up to like nutrition, for example, then training, like, you know, whatever. But I think this does throw a little wrench into, or maybe just adds nuance to it, right? Maybe we're like, well, maybe not in untrained individuals, whereas maybe it does make a difference in trained individuals. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this doesn't really change a lot of what we would end up recommending for somebody in terms of like trying something, that iterative approach. I think the reason why we find this interesting is because of how it relates to or clashes with those like hormone hypotheses, right? Because of how prevalent ideas are around, you know, what your blood levels have to be for these things. And so this would kind of challenge some of those things, really in any direction, you know, research into this androgen receptor aspect, which is not modifiable. You can't like inject yourself with androgen receptors the way you can with the actual hormone. The other thought I had is something I alluded to earlier. Maybe it's not necessarily the greater androgen receptor content, but maybe there's some polymorphisms in the receptor itself. Measuring this is certainly outside of my area of expertise, but whether there are ways to more directly measure receptor like binding affinity to the hormone, receptor activity, things like that, because there are different ways that these hormone signaling cascades can be altered, turned up, turned down. And so I wonder, maybe that would be the next place to look is like, you know, are there genetic differences in terms of, you know, binding affinity to the androgen? And does that impact things in either particular direction? Maybe it binds more and that's what leads to more activity. Maybe it binds less and it makes it more free to, you know, dissociate in the cell or something. There's all sorts of different ways that you could, you know, foresee this playing out. So it is interesting. It just ties into, you know, the wide individual variation. And so, like I said, less practical implications, which usually means that I tend to care less about things with less practical implications. However, this, I think, retains more interest than usual for such a thing for us, just because of how it relates to the hormone hypothesis, which will absolutely never die.
Yeah. Honestly, I just posted on Threads. I mean, you probably saw that having a higher testosterone level within the normal range is not better than having a lower testosterone level within the range. Optimization of testosterone levels is keyword for scam, right? And people lost their minds, right? Now, granted, I could have typed out another couple thousand words to fully explain all the nuance behind that, but I didn't. So honest, I guess I asked for it, you know?
Yeah.
But that's my bad. Next time I will make sure to post an essay if I ever want to say anything that some people may view as controversial. All right, last study here on episode 308, so our September 2024 research review with Dr. Austin Baraki. This is titled Chronic Use of Antihypertensive Medications and Peak Exercise Blood Pressure in Adult Men and Women from the Ball State Cohort. I'm going to guess that you know where the study was done.
I take it wherever Ball State is. Never heard of it.
Heck yeah. Hey, man. They're a powerhouse. So yeah, this was published in the September issue of this year in Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise. So there's talk. This is talking about what happens to blood pressure during exercise in people who have hypertension or high blood pressure and are taking high blood pressure medications, antihypertensives. So some little background here. Blood pressure is the force of your blood pushing against the walls of your blood vessels as it's circulating. High blood pressure, also known as hypertension, is when the blood pressure is consistently too high. I think normal is somewhere less than 120. That's the top number, systolic blood pressure, and less than 80. That's diastolic blood pressure. That's the bottom number. So normal is less than 120 over 80. Now, nearly half of adults have elevated blood pressure, so something higher than 120 over 80. And of those with diagnosed hypertension, only a fraction are adequately treated, meaning that whatever combination of lifestyle, medications, and so on, they don't actually get to this sort of blood pressure goal, which in most cases, but not all cases, is 120 over 80. Now, we know that exercise reduces resting blood pressure seemingly in a dose-dependent manner. So the more exercise that people do in general produces a greater reduction in resting blood pressure. We also know that increases in strength correlate with a lower resting blood pressure, meaning that those who get strongest on a program seem to have a better blood pressure response, generally speaking. We think this has something to do with an overlap between like fitness-related adaptations, like performance-related adaptations, and health-related adaptations. If you're a responder to the program, we think you're getting all of the responses, but that's still speculation. Finally, exercise appears to be well-tolerated in those with elevated blood pressure, despite all exercise increasing blood pressure while it's being performed, sometimes to very high levels. If normal blood pressure is less than 120 over 80, would you be surprised to learn that during a leg press one rep max, it's been measured to be over 400 millimeters of mercury? If you're a cardiologist listening to this, you're like, what in the... You know what I was going to say there. That's far too high. That's what they would say, but apparently seems to be well tolerated. Now, there are some standard blood pressure responses that have been characterized to exercise. So with people doing what's called a graded exercise test, like on a treadmill, if they were going to test their fitness, like get a VO2 max, for example, we have substantial amount of data on normal blood pressure responses. And there's an absolute criteria here that's been used to characterize what's called an exaggerated blood pressure response to exercise. So for example, if you're a guy, Austin, if it's you, you're on the treadmill doing this graded exercise test and your systolic blood pressure goes up to over 210 millimeters of mercury, they call that an exaggerated blood pressure response. For women, it's 190. There's also a few databases out there that have come up with their own sort of definitions. So for example, the FREND database. It's called the Fitness Registry and Importance of Exercise, a national database, the FREND database, FREND Registry. They think that if you're greater than the 90th percentile for your specific age and sex group, then during the test, then that's an exaggerated response. And you could have a blunted response if you're lower than the 10th percentile. So just more normative data stuff. So with that in mind, there have been relatively few studies looking at differences in blood pressure responses during exercise in individuals with elevated blood pressure, high blood pressure, who are taking medication compared to those who have normal blood pressure and who are not taking medication. So that's what the study did. They took just over 2,500 middle-aged adults and basically had them do a graded exercise test, like they were trying to test their VO2 max. 27% of the sample had hypertension and were taking medication. Now, the results are significant for the medicated individuals had a greater prevalence of what's known as an exaggerated blood pressure response. So using the absolute criteria, that means a blood pressure greater than 210 if you're a guy or greater than 190 systolic if you're a woman. Well, 28% of those taking medication for high blood pressure had this exaggerated response, whereas only 11% of the non-medicated individuals had an exaggerated response. That's about the same proportion using this other FREND criteria. It's a different definition, but the same sort of proportion here. So again, more of the folks who were medicated to treat their high blood pressure had an exaggerated response to exercise. As far as those, the proportion of those having a normal blood pressure response to exercise, 80% of the unmedicated folks had a normal blood pressure response, whereas 70 to 75% of the medicated individuals had a normal blood pressure response. So still pretty good overall. My takeaways – oh, sorry. I have one more interesting fact. Austin, you'll like this. Individuals on beta blockers had a higher peak systolic blood pressure during exercise compared to unmedicated individuals by about 10 millimeters of mercury. They were about 183 on average compared to 173 to the unmedicated individuals, which I thought was interesting because you would expect, while beta blockers in general are not a great antihypertensive, you would expect that not only are they kind of limited on how high their heart rate can get, but also it has some effect on blood pressure. So I would have predicted the opposite. I don't know. Would you have predicted that they would have a higher blood pressure on average?
Yeah, I mean, to pretty much echoing what you said, they're not great blood pressure medicines, but they are still drugs that have an impact on blood pressure to a greater extent than not taking any blood pressure medicine. So I agree, that's a little bit of a surprising finding.
Yeah. So I don't know. My interpretation is that, yeah, overall, this study showed that medicated individuals had a greater prevalence of an exaggerated blood pressure response compared to unmedicated individuals. I don't know that that's surprising to me, because when I think about it, I'm like, well, if you're on a blood pressure medication, that means you have at least one existing cardiovascular disease risk factor, in this case, high blood pressure, but likely have other cardiovascular disease risk factors, whether it's dyslipidemia, so abnormal like blood lipoprotein levels, low fitness, smoking, whatever. And it's like, yeah, I guess I would predict, you know, if we're looking at which group is going to have a higher prevalence of exaggerated blood pressure responses. Is it going to be the people on medication or the people not on medication? I would predict the medicated individuals if we make the assumption that the unmedicated individuals are otherwise healthy. If we're talking about two groups of people that are like, you both have the same incidence of high blood pressure and only one is medicated, I would predict then the unmedicated individuals to have a higher peak response.
Yeah, you're just enriching the treated population. The treated population are by definition enriched for those who have hypertension and the hypertensive risk factors, and who will by definition have a greater prevalence of that for sure, compared with the others, which are not enriched for those risk factors.
Yeah. Well, so here's a question, Dr. Baraki. Do you think that there's a risk of having this exaggerated response? Like, we think that individuals with high blood pressure during exercise, they have some like sympathetic nervous system overactivity that in general is not really touched by the antihypertensive medications, doesn't really do anything for that mechanism. And so, I don't know, I could make up this idea that like, if it's an exaggerated blood pressure response, maybe their heart's got to work a little bit harder, and so you have a higher risk of like left ventricular hypertrophy due to exercising and having this exaggerated response. Do you think that's, am I blowing that out of proportion?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, and I would not say that I'm intimately familiar with all of the data in the space. I definitely recognize this kind of like exercise-induced hypertensive response as a thing that gets noted, particularly like when patients get stress tests done and things like that. My concern over it is not so much that when they have that elevation in blood pressure during exercise that is disproportionately high, that like instantaneously in that second is the thing that I'm most concerned about, which might be different than how most lay folks think about it, right? Because if they saw, you know, either of our deadlift faces, they might think, oh, well, your blood pressure must be high at that very second. And at that second, that's when something's got to blow or something like that. And that's, for the most part, not how these types of things tend to present. But rather, my concern over somebody with that hypertensive response is kind of more indicative of their pathophysiology, their overall, you know, condition, that they are by definition a higher risk hypertensive patient for having some kind of a cardiovascular event, like at any time, whether or not it's during, pre, post exercise, in the middle of the night, or at some other time. It's just kind of like evidence of them being at higher risk in general. Now, if I dug into the literature, it's not like I would be shocked if there was some signal for maybe they do tend to have, you know, a bit more incidence of events during exertion compared with those who don't. I don't know that that is true, or that it is a very strong signal, but rather my concern over high blood pressure, for the most part, and I explain this to patients all the time, because people freak out about their own blood pressure readings, and they'll come to the ER, and ER, you know, folks will sometimes call us to like admit people to the hospital. You know, that's happening less these days, I think, as people are recognizing that high blood pressure with no symptoms whatsoever does not need to be, is not an emergency. But high blood pressure causes problems over years to decades, right? There are certain situations where it can cause problems in a much shorter time frame. Those would be emergency situations where I would admit you to the ICU and put you on, you know, very short acting medicines to get control of things quickly. But that's a tiny fraction of the population with blood pressure issues. So I worry much more about longer term blood pressure control on average. And if people have this hypertensive response to exercise in general, or if they're treated with medicines and they're still having it, I wonder if that's also a marker of like under treatment, you know?
Yeah, I was going to, okay, so follow me on this, right? So I think I can, and this is admittedly an overgeneralization because there's definitely the potential for more stuff going on here, but there's a pretty well-established relationship between resting systolic blood pressure, so what is your blood pressure at rest, and peak systolic blood pressure, like what would happen on a graded exercise test. So if somebody is having this exaggerated response to exercise, so their blood pressure is, again, greater than 90th percentile for their age and sex, or it's greater than 210 if you're a guy, 190 if you're a woman, systolic blood pressure, to me that is more predictive that your resting blood pressure is not very well controlled, suggesting like under treatment, right? Now, if the thought is that, well, look, that may be true and we're trying to get a handle on it. So in the interim, we know that exercise is good for lowering resting blood pressure. But in the interim, why don't you lower the intensity of the exercise a little bit? Because there's some theoretical risk of exposing these people unnecessarily to this higher intensity exercise and they have this exaggerated response. I would probably say, hey, you know, that's fine. And here's why it's fine. Because when we look at the data on exercise and blood pressure lowering effect, so what it does to resting blood pressure, the strongest predictor of how big of an effect you get is volume, not intensity, right? So if we figured out like, hey, go into 70% of your max heart rate or whatever, you tolerate that just fine. You're within these sort of normative data here. But if you go to 80% or 90%, you have this exaggerated response. Great. You don't need to go to 80% or 90%. You're not getting more fitness by going heavier. Harder. Sorry. It's a Freudian slip. I keep thinking about other dumb things I hear in the fitness industry. Like,
yeah.
So I don't know. Does that all make sense to you? Or you think I'm just confabulating to make myself sound smart?
I mean, if people are doing their training for health related purposes, then I think that that's a justifiable case that, you know, you're trying to find the sweet spot of stimulus to get the effect you want and balancing out the fatigue and the downsides and potential real or theoretical risks. And I think that that's a fine way to frame that conversation. And then the last thought that I had that came to mind is different people can have high blood pressure via different mechanisms. And so this is part of why when we've talked before about the use of blood pressure medicines, for example, in situations where that's necessary, if people have pretty high blood pressure, I tend to practice in a way where I will prescribe somebody low doses of multiple different medicines at the same time instead of cranking up the dose of one medicine all the way up to the max. And there's multiple reasons for that. But one is that, well, if different people have different mechanisms, then by using different medicines that work differently, you're more likely to hit that patient's mechanism of hypertension. And by keeping them at low doses, you're sparing them the side effect risk of higher doses of a single medicine, which may be missing their mechanism entirely. So for example, you know, beta blockers, alpha blockers, those kind of drugs, those work on that kind of more adrenergic sympathetic system and how that can impact people's blood pressure. ACE inhibitors and ARBs work on the renin-angiotensin system and how that can impact people's blood pressure, a different system. And then diuretics work by way of, you know, well, this is a complicated topic. I'll spare people, but they work at least initially by way of modifying sodium handling in the kidney and like plasma volume and things like that. And so, you know, using different ones with different mechanisms, you can be more likely to hit people's mechanism and spare them the side effects. And so, you know, I also wonder about that manifestation in this kind of a study where we saw differences in people's, exercise hypertensive response, and some people might have a greater one, even if they are treated, because of their unique mechanism of hypertension, maybe more sympathetically driven, for example, and they're more prone to having that compared with somebody who has a different mechanism that might show less of that kind of an impact. And so that would be a way that I think about it, not only in terms of the physiology of it, but also how I would treat it.
Multiple agents. Yeah, you're just a shill for big pharma. I knew it.
I'm a shill for $3 medicines. Yes, exactly.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Hey, that's a wrap here on episode 308. It's our September 2024 research review. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for spending time with us today. Before you guys go anywhere, though, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.